August 2nd, 2017. You're looking live at Athens, Georgia. This is episode 653 of the Will Leach Experience podcast on sports on earth. I am the aforementioned Will Leach, and I thank you for spending part of your day with me. The trade deadline is over. There are still some more trades to come, I suppose. But the trade deadline is over with one big, huge Yu Darvish trade coming right at the buzzer or after the buzzer. Brief side note, you young critters out there probably do not remember when the trade deadline was inexplicably at midnight. I was working for the Sporting News Online in 1998, I believe. And I was the only person there. That tells you how news organizations have changed in the last 20 years. The only staffer that was there for the trade deadline for Wires was me, a 22-year-old kid who was just updating the website. Midnight came and went, and I wrote a front page cover blurb for the sportingnews.com saying there were no trades that happened tonight. And I was preparing to go home, and then I remembered I'd left something at my desk. I walked back to my desk and noticed that Randy Johnson had just been traded to the Houston Astros. Otherwise, the Sporting News Online would have had 8 hours at least of a wrong story headline with Randy Johnson, the big Hall of Famer, being traded at deadline, not actually in there. I'm glad it's not at midnight anymore. We all saw the madness on Monday when everyone just lost their mind the minute that Yu Darvish got traded. Much more exciting now. Probably smart to have that be 4 o'clock rather than midnight. Times have changed in 20 years. Anyway, to talk about all of that this week is our friend Joe Sheehan. Joe, we've had on in the past, of course. We usually do a big preseason podcast with him, and usually do something over the All-Star break where we kind of talk about the state of the game. We did not get the opportunity to do that this year, so we're going to kind of do a post-deadline primer for everything moving forward. So, of course, Joe is a writer for Sports Illustrated, but I know him most as a purveyor of the great Joe Sheehan baseball newsletter. I read that thing obsessively, across the board. It's one of my favorites. One of my favorite baseball writers in the world. One of the founders of Baseball Prospectus. So we're going to talk to him about the deadline. Of course, please rate and review us on iTunes. The music is by the Sundogs. We'll be back. I got two, maybe even three podcasts next week. Busy week next week. But right now, enjoy the post-deadline podcast with Joe Sheehan. All right, Joe, welcome back. I'm, as you know, you are one of my absolute favorite guests to have on. It's an honor as always. So thanks for coming on with me.
No, I'm a devoted listener, Will, and you know I love all your stuff, so I'm happy to do this.
Well, the deadline has passed, and everything is resolved. Everything is fine. You know, it's funny. Fangraphs had a thing about this last week, and about how I've written about this before, too, about we get so fired up at the deadline because it's fun. You know, the deadline is fun. It's this big thing that happens in the middle of the season, but very rarely does it affect anything. And I think this year the Dodgers World Series odds went up, but nobody else's, I think, changed even more than like 1% because of the moves. I'm curious, this is always kind of a fun thing because, you know, as someone, we follow baseball year round. It's kind of an obsessive thing. Whenever these like big moments of the trade deadline and the things where like it becomes... It's hard anytime you look at this stuff in a macro sense when you're like, you know, this doesn't make a huge deal, but it's also just a really fun thing. It's almost like we're all playing strat cards with these guys for a day.
Yeah, and I was saying to somebody yesterday, like the trade deadline in the era of Twitter is actually enhanced kind of the experience. It's like a lot of things. You're enjoying it as a group. I remember trade deadlines, you know, when I was in college and post-college, Randy Gisarelli and I would be on the phone at midnight, irritating the heck out of our fiancés / wives and talking and waiting for everything that would come out of Peter Gammons' mouth on Baseball Tonight. I don't know that I get as into the leading up to it part anymore. I want to know when something happens. Sonny Gray has been traded, great. The 2 months of Sonny Gray is going to be traded interests me a lot less now. You end up writing fanfic, like, what would the rotation be like if the I don't care about any of that. Tell me when news actually happens. So I have enormous respect for Ken Rosenthal and all those guys who chase down that stuff, and I think they do incredible work. But in terms of my particular enjoyment, I want to know about something when it actually happens. I don't care who had the second best offer. Tell me, you know, who actually got the guy.
Yeah, it's funny. I remember Jeff Passan was on the Ringer podcast last year. You know, he's now – he kind of breaks some of this news himself now too. But he kind of talked about how he kind of hates the trade deadline. He's come around on it, but he's like it's weird. It's like the trade deadline turns everybody into an NFL reporter for like 2 days. And that's that. And it's fine. That's fine. But like, you know, Passan's like a really, like, I think Passan's smart about baseball and like is a good reporter. But then all of a sudden, all context is out the window for 2 days. It's just the, right. Padre, you know, Yankees in on hand. It's just the idea that this phrase Yankees in on hand is a meaningful thing. I see it. I'm like, oh, that's something that affects my life somehow. It's just kind of strange. But anyway, so I want to go into kind of, we can talk a little bit, obviously, the deadline moves, but also just kind of moving forward, what's kind of division by division we're looking at, not only for these last 2 months of the season, but really how some of the moves or non-moves will affect these teams moving forward. So I want to start, of course, with the biggest story of the deadline, which was, of course, the Dodgers. Speaking of that kind of Twitter moment, you know, I made a conscious effort in the year 2017 to spend less time on Twitter because the world has me. Like, if I'm not careful, I'll just be like, oh, the world's horrible, and Twitter will just take me over. But the deadline is obviously an exception to that. And that moment when Rosenthal put out Darvish traded, but nobody knew to whom yet, was, I'm sad to say that it's come to this in the world, but it was actually a pretty exciting baseball moment.
Right, everybody had kind of gotten away from the deadline and started downing their scotches and their beers at 4:05, and then Ken comes off the top rope with this. It was great. it was a surprise. I want to say the Manny Ramirez deal, when the Dodgers got Ramirez, that was also something that got announced like a half hour after the deadline. And I think Paul Swiden mentioned on Fangraphs, Paul Swiden mentioned the Nomar Garciaparra trade coming down after the deadline. So there is something of a history of this happening.
I mentioned this in the intro. I was working at the Sporting News when the Randy Johnson trade went down.
Yep.
And that's
yep,
back
yep.
when it was at midnight. And
I so love that.
I almost left. I was like, I'm sorry, listeners, you have to hear this again. But that's how different the deadline was 20 years ago. The one guy on staff at the Sporting News, which was still like the Sporting News at that time, was me at midnight, 21-year-old snot-nosed kid, the only guy that knew how to update the website. So, and I almost left and missed that trade because it didn't break until like 12:20. So it's funny, we did kind of forget that, like, there's not at 4 o'clock, just because Twitter says 4 o'clock doesn't mean all the news is gone. And I think it was a good reminder of that.
Right, there's a gap between a trade being reported and it getting to the, you know, reported to the league, and then the reporter finds out and he verifies it. So, you know, there's always good, but you know, I think safely now as we talk about this on Tuesday afternoon.
Yeah,
I think we're past the point of anything happening. But no, that was a big moment, and then it took a while for the news of who the Dodgers had actually traded for Darvish to come out. There was a lot of initially we learned that Alex Verdugo, who's this right fielder, who's a tremendous hitter for average, really great bat to ball skills. He's, I believe, their third best prospect. There was question about whether he'd be in the deal, and he wasn't. And then it came out that it was going to be Calhoun and two lower level prospects. And I got to tell you, I mean, I think that's a pretty good haul for 12 starts of Yu Darvish. I mean, one of the disconnects that happens at the trade deadline is you get caught up in the name, or you get caught up in how the guy was 4 years ago. And I saw a lot of this yesterday with Darvish. Oh my God, Yu Darvish. Well, you're not trading Yu Darvish's strat card from 2013. You're not trading Yu Darvish, the guy who lit up the world in 12 and 13. You're trading a guy with 380 innings the last 4 years with a 4 ERA, and more to the point, just 12 starts of him. That doesn't have an enormous amount of value. So when you see teams trading these expiring contracts, you have to – that's a basketball term, I know, but you have to kind of look at them and say, you know, the fame of the player and his great track record doesn't really mean as much to the team acquiring him. They're trading for 12 starts. So I thought the Rangers actually did very well to get Calhoun in the deal. And you know, we'll see what happens with the right-hander. He's a tall drink of water, just started pitching a couple of years ago. The infielder is probably just a utility infielder down the road, but Calhoun can hit, man. Calhoun can flat out hit. I comped him to, and I shouldn't do comps, I know, but Frank Catalanato, if you remember him from the 1990s, couldn't play second base but could flat out hit, ended up having a nice little career as a four-corners guy. Calhoun is just a tremendous, tremendous hitter. We'll see if he hits for average in the majors, but he walks, he hits for power. He'll eventually probably, I think he'll be a left fielder. That's it. To me, that's when you turn 12 starts of Yu Darvish in a lost season into Willie Calhoun, that's good work.
Yeah, this is always the back and forth. Well, and really, the Dodgers. We'll talk about the Rockies and the Diamondbacks as well. But for me, the Dodgers are the big thing. You know, this is the question that really comes up with every deadline. You know, Neil Payne had a thing at 5:38 last week talking about how the smart play is for teams, not for teams that are just trying to get in the playoffs to make a big trade, but for a team like the Dodgers, who already are in the tournament, as we say, but really just want to maximize their odds of winning once they get there. On one hand, I totally understand that. On the other hand, you know, it's also possible that if the Rockies fall, let's say the Rockies end up winning 86 games, or they really fall off, but hang on to the second wild card, and win 86, 87 games, finish 26, 27 games behind the Dodgers, but win that first wild card game, all it takes is just one weird play in that first game, and that 30, 40, however many game difference is gone in that one game. So I'm always wondering, I know obviously this is a postseason trade for them, but it's still anytime that you're trading that much into the future, and of course the Dodgers aren't the only team that did this, for something that really you're trading for 10 starts of Darvish, but what you're really trading for is one start of Darvish or one and a half, like a key start, Darvish over a McCarthy, for example. And that's why I always wonder about these trades. While it looks great and you look at them and you're like, wow, they've got Kershaw, Darvish, and Wood, how's anyone going to beat them? It's the playoffs, and great teams with great pitching staffs lose all the time.
We have unfortunately not been able to make that argument stick in the wider baseball world, and certainly in the wider sports world. But it's one we have to try to keep making, because I'm already dreading the Cubs beating the Dodgers in six and the crazy hot takes we're going to get about the choking Dodgers for the fifth straight year. I'm dreading it already, because the nature of baseball, especially with the way the NFL is very much the best quarterback wins, the NBA is very much the best team always wins. Baseball is literally the complete opposite of that. Well, I guess hockey is the complete opposite of that, where it's just 16 teams randomly thrown together. But in baseball, it's just – you think about it. If you finish – let's say the Dodgers were to finish 26 games ahead of whoever they play in the wild card in the first round, whoever comes out of the wild card game, which they could do. 26 games. That's a huge – God, the Dodgers are so much better than the – it's one game a week. They're one win better a week than these other teams. And over the course of a week, which is a best of five series – you're flipping one win. So it's not a big upset. You're always an underdog to the field. You mentioned coming in the percentages. I want to say it was Nefiko said the Dodgers' chance of winning the World Series went up 2.7% yesterday. And you know, getting Darvish helps them by that much. Even now, Prospectus has the Dodgers at 24% to win the World Series. The best team in baseball, a team that could win 110, 112 games, is going to be a huge underdog to the field in the playoffs. And there's no way around that, because it's baseball. It's just the nature of baseball. And I feel like I'm going to be saying this now for the next 10 weeks. I'm probably going to be saying it until the Dodgers actually win the World Series. But it's very hard to get people to understand that the best team in baseball just doesn't have that great an advantage over, you know, the way they have it in other sports. And so, yeah, you add a Darvish and you're marginally better. You go from – let's say it's versus Maeda. So the second game of the division series, the Dodgers will go from being a -180 favorite to a -200 favorite. That's a really small change, but it's the entire reason they made this trade.
Okay, then look at the other two teams in the division. The Rockies, it's funny, you wrote a really great newsletter this week about how much things have changed for Jonathan Lucroy in one year and how this move to the Rockies could end up being maybe the last chance for him to kind of get some of that value that he's lost in the last year. Do you think that, to me, you know, the Diamondbacks obviously getting J.D. Martinez, that feels like a very smart strategic strike. And I think it was also that trade was one of the reasons that there weren't any hitters moved, because people were like, why am I going to, if that's all I'm going to get back, why would I even bother? I took me this long to get to the Cardinals, but I think it's another reason the Cardinals didn't make a trade for offense, because they saw, wait, that we're going to have to, no one's trading anyone if that's all they're going to get for a J.D. Martinez. So,
folks, if you had 1035 pool for when Will was going to first get to the Cardinals.
Yeah, I can't believe you waited that long. But it's funny, when I look at those two teams, the Diamondbacks, maybe because, again, Cardinals just played these teams in seven games. You look at the Diamondbacks, that looks like a team that's pretty solidly constructed and is pretty well put together. And it's hard to imagine them not hanging on to that spot. I think the Rockies, I don't know who the team that does it, but that looks like a team that could be had to me, particularly their rotation. Gray's come around a little bit, but their rotation started to fall off. And Nishik helps the bullpen, but I don't know. To me, the Rockies, I think it's – it wasn't long ago, 2 months ago, the Rockies were like the story in baseball, and now they feel like a team that's just barely kind of hanging on. Do you think, A, they're the type of team that can hang on, and B, if they do, do they – like, is this it? Like, because it feels like this is the Rockies' special season in a lot of ways where everything's falling for them, and the best they may be able to hope for is a road wild card game.
Well, I don't, because I think their core is fine. I think if you look at Arenado, LeMahieu, Gray – I think their core will be fine. I think what's interesting to look at how many things have gone wrong for them this year. I mean, David Dahl hasn't played. He's probably not going to. I assume the trade for Jonathan Lucroy means they've given up on Tom Murphy playing this year. I mean, these were two guys who were supposed to be plus hitters for them. Murphy, particularly at the catching spot. So I do think the Rockies will be fine. I think everybody in that division is screwed because of the Dodgers, but could the Rockies be an 85, 86 win team over the next few years? Yeah. But you were right. I mean, they always look like they were going to fall off because so much of their success was these Senzatella, German Marquez guys with really good ERAs and numbers that completely didn't match them. And they played some of the best defense we've seen the Rockies play in their franchise history. The question I have for you is who's going to catch them? There are only six teams over 500 in the National League. The Brewers are barely, and the Brewers in a week might not even be over 500. You might only have five teams over 500. And this has been the National League's issue for a while with kind of so many teams on this rebuilding front. And the middle tier the middle tier got blown up this year between the Pirates and their issues, the Giants, the Mets, like all the teams that might have been putting pressure on the Rockies aren't. So I look at the Rockies and go, if they can just get to 84 wins, I mean, to me, they'd have to almost fall to 500 to start putting somebody, the Brewers or some of these other teams into play. So again, there are six teams in the American League that look over at the National League and they're like, geez, if we could just compete with those guys. But the way it stands right now, they've got to put five teams in the playoffs, and I think the Rockies probably are the best of the remaining bunch. I think from a fan standpoint, just to give us some, because with three division races dead, it'd be nice to see the Rockies continue to slip, maybe the Brewers or the Cardinals or the Pirates put together a winning streak to make the wild card race more interesting. But right now, I think you got to look at the Rockies and say, even with all their flaws, they're favored over the field.
Yeah, that brings us to the NL Central, and we can probably just do the NL Central and the NL East in one, because you're right. If that's the danger here is if the Cubs are clicking now the way everyone was expecting them to, and they're certainly acting like a team that's planning on going for it this year, and is certainly very comfortable with where they stand, considering how scary it was for them 3 weeks ago. I mean, I think the prospectus odds had them, the Brewers, as the favorite in that division.
Very briefly,
for like a day or two. And so, but if you look at them, if the wild card is generally settled and all of these divisions are generally settled, it's funny. There was a lot of talk about, now we can get to the Cardinals, about why some frustration from Cardinal fans of why they didn't make a trade. But to me, if you couldn't get better than what you thought you're going to get draft pick for Lance Lynn, and listen, because of the new rules, they might not have got what they got in the past. But the idea, if you're not going to sell Lynn, you're not really a seller, and there's no reason to buy. So really, the only logical thing to do for a team like the Cardinals, or even the Brewers, who kind of did a marginal kind of bullpen moves, they kind of did like the old Pirates moves where it's like, we're showing our fans we're kind of in, but we're not actually going in this season. That seems like a logical move really for all of those teams, the Cardinals and the Brewers, and even the Pirates to that extent, is to just kind of stay out of this, and maybe you'll catch a break, but not to get your eyes bigger than your stomach.
I completely agree. I look at the Cardinals, the Giants, the Rangers. There are a lot of teams that are probably out of this year's race, but are also not looking to 2020. They expect to be contenders in 2018. The core is in place. The Cardinals certainly fit that mold. So what are you going to do? I mean, if you have an expiring contract, expiring asset, you get what you can for him, like the Rangers did with Darvish. But beyond that, what can you really do? You're not going to trade Matt Carpenter. You're not going to trade Dexter Fowler or Carlos Martinez. This is your team. It didn't work out this year. You come back next year. Not everybody is going to fit into the rebuild or the tank or win model. Some teams are going to be in the middle just because of the nature of their roster. So I think there were a number of those. I do think there were teams, and we'll get to the American League, but there were teams that probably should have sold more because they're not going to be good next year, and there were mistakes made in that regard. But I look at the middle tier of the National League and see teams that fully expect to be back contending for certainly the wild card, possibly the division in 2018. Throw the Mets in there as well, I guess.
Yeah, and I guess that leads us to the Cubs then. It's funny, the big thing for the Cubs, I wrote a piece about this for Sports on Earth, is just kind of the fundamental strangeness of, you know, we've spent the last 5 years talking about the Cubs farm system, and here they come, and here they come, and this is going to be a perpetual thing they constantly have going. And with the Candelario trade for Wilson and Avila, they actually now have no top 100 prospects. Now, again, the idea that top 100 prospects don't actually get you wins, like, that's still kind of an arbitrary thing, but certainly. I look back, this is actually the first time since Baseball America has done rankings that the Cubs have not had a player in the top 100, which is really kind of a strange thing coming on the heels of this time where we've all had the assumption that they're going to be this constantly reloading thing. I get why they're doing it, and it totally makes sense. I respect the urgency a year after kind of having that breakthrough, and it's not like they're like everyone on their team is the Tigers now or something. Like, they still have a lot of young players, but certainly there is an interesting kind of thing to watch the arc of this Cubs season, where struggle, and they get hot at the right time, and now all of a sudden they're all in really for the next couple of years on this, while you see the Dodgers kind of making what looked like the Cubs' amazing team. We may not see like a team like the Cubs in a while. All of a sudden the Dodgers come in and they're actually better. What do you think of that Cubs move, both in the short and the long term?
Well, I think what we've seen in the Cubs do over the last 14 months, going back to the Gleyber Torres trade, is just say this is our team. The 2016 to 2020 Cubs, the Brizzo Cubs, surrounded, of course, by other talent. We're going to try to get as many championships as we can out of this core. So they've traded value in the 2020s in trading Jimenez, in trading Torres. Those are the two big ones. And I think it's kind of saying, hey, well, this, we have a core. And you, not just those guys, but Russell's 23. Baez is, what, 24, 25. Schwarber, for all I've beaten him up, is 24. Elmore is 24. They have such a young core now that I don't think they have to necessarily worry about Jimenez and Torres. They're going to have time to draft and sign the next group of guys before they actually need to replace any of the guys that are currently in their lineup. Plus, you know, money. So they'll be able to buy players as well. So I understand. I don't say whether I like it or not. I think individually I could argue with these trades. I think the Jimenez for Quintana trade made plenty of sense. I think they overpaid for Aroldis Chapman. You know, the Candelario trade, I think it's fine. Candelario literally could not get on the field for this team. But when you look at philosophically, I think there's something to be said for saying, look, we have a five-year window here. This isn't a one-year window. We can be the best team in baseball for the next 5 years. Let's try to win as many championships as we can with these guys. I'm fine with it because I think there's plenty of time for them to restock the farm system. And one of the things we know about this organization is that they've been very good at finding young talent.
And then I think the last, unless you want to talk about the Mets, and I don't really want to. And to me, one thing, probably on a future podcast, I'd love to talk to you about the weirdness of the Phillies. Like, I've mentioned this when we saw all of these teams kind of drop and go out of the contention cycle eventually, because they're all trying to beat the Cubs and the Astros, which makes sense. I get the idea. But eventually there's going to be a team that just doesn't happen.
Like, yep,
it's going to happen. And it looks like the Phillies might be that team, but that might be a later conversation. For me, the Nationals are interesting too, because they are in a clear, obvious, we got 2 years. We've got Harper. As long as we got Harper, we feel like we've got a chance to win. And it's weird though, because you almost feel bad for the Nationals, because you think about, like, I mean, you know, 10 years ago, there were no dominant teams. Like the idea that you've got now, this Nationals team, they're 2 years that they can do it, running against the Cubs and the Dodgers. Do you kind of like their kind of volume approach to the bullpen, and does this look like a team that can stand up with those two?
The problem I have with how they've built their bullpen is it doesn't fit their manager. One of the things they did last year in acquiring Melanson was make things easier for Dusty Baker. And Dusty Baker has a number of good qualities, and he's certainly not the guy he was in 2003. He's fixed a lot of the leaks in his game, but he's not Buck Showalter. He's not somebody who manages the late innings of a game very well. And so if Dusty Baker is my manager, I want to give him a closer, an eighth inning guy, and a seventh inning guy. And what the Nationals have now is an improved bullpen that's very fluid, that it's not completely clear who should be those guys. I mean, I don't know how much you remember about last year's playoff series, but Melanson pitched the ninth. But leading up to it, you know, Baker did figure out Sammy Solis had to pitch a lot against that lefty heavy Dodger lineup, and Oliver Perez had to pitch a lot. I don't trust Dusty Baker with this group of relievers. I feel like he's going to find the way to lose the game. I know that might be ungenerous to Baker, and it might not matter that the Nationals could go out and score 8 runs a game because their offense is just that good. But when I look at them in the playoff series, that's where I think they could get into trouble, is a bullpen that just doesn't really pair well with the weaknesses of their manager. It's really something. You look ahead to a Nationals-Cubs division series that really is essentially a 2-3 game in terms of the overall seeds in the playoffs. That's going to be a 2-3. There are not going to – the AL teams are all, by that point, unless the Astros magically find a bunch of pitching, that's going to be your 1, 2, and 3, Dodgers, Nationals, Cubs going into October. So we're going to have a division series that's basically a national semifinal. Anyway, it's I think the Nationals are a heck of a team. I do think it's unfortunate that they've mapped their – they've timed it poorly. One thing to remember about the 2018 Nationals, if they do decide to continue to go all in, they still have Victor Robles. Mm. They still have Soto, and they still have Fetty to trade. They still have a lot of trade chips if they do want to just go all in for 2018.
You brought up I do feel bad last thing in the Nationals. You do feel bad. You know, obviously, they've never been able to get past the NLDS, and this year it feels like, all right, they've been terrific. They've had the division forever, and they've been very comfortably ahead, and everything seems to be coming together for them, and they have to play the freaking Cubs in the NLDS. You got to feel – they told us, of course, you know, the Cardinals make a run.
If Strasburg is healthy, I think the Nationals will be favored in that series because they're going to have such an edge in the first two pitching slots. But again, it's Madden versus Dusty Baker in a best of, and I know – even with all the problems Madden had last year, I think I know where I'm betting in that.
All right, you mentioned the Astros. Let's go over to the AL West. Do you think, as all these other teams may, as the Yankees made their gray push and as the Dodgers made theirs, did the Astros just get shut out in a situation where they should have made a move, or did they have a little bit? It's funny, you can tell that this is that Lou now has a very similar thing as coming from the Cardinals organization. They weren't — one thing that the Astros really kind of don't do is, and certainly did not do in this situation, was do the somewhat irrational long term trade for the idea that you're going for it right now. They kind of stayed out of this starting pitching market. Do you think that will cost them, or do you think they're going to be okay?
I'm fine with what they did. I think they traded for Darvish without trading Tucker. I probably would have been fine with that too. If they had traded Fisher and Martez, or one of Fisher and Martez and some other guys, if they had put a Dodgers type package out there for Darvish, that also would have been fine. I'm okay with them not making that trade. There's so much uncertainty with their starting pitching right now. We talked about it in the context of the Dodgers. The Astros' next 2 months is functionally irrelevant. They're not going to get caught by a team in the division. They're probably not going to get caught by another team in the league for home field advantage, and they're probably not going to catch the Dodgers for home field advantage in the World Series. The Astros are what they are. So all that really matters is getting everybody healthy. And if they had traded for anyone, and they did trade for Francisco Liriano, but if they had traded for a starter, the next relevant start by that pitcher would have been October 3rd. So are you really going to give up, you know, Derek Fisher and somebody else for possibly one playoff start? I completely understand, especially when you look at them a year down the road, 2 years down the road. If they're going to have to pay Altuve, who's going to be like a $600 million man at this rate, if they're going to have to pay Springer, you're going to need Tucker and Fisher and Martez and Whitley making the minimum to finance that. The Astros are a large market team. We don't talk about that enough. They don't have to run an $80 million payroll, but even if you're going to run $130 million payroll, you're going to need some of these low-cost players. I'm fine with what they did. I think we could see them be active. I love the Liriano pickup, actually. They didn't really give up that much, and you look at Liriano as somebody who could be their Andrew Miller. We'll see how he adapts to the bullpen, but the possibility that he goes to the bullpen and becomes like this once through the lineup two-inning monster is very real.
Yeah, that would be fun. And it does seem like the type of thing – they've got a ton of those guys already with Davinsky and yeah, like the idea of – they've already – like they've kind of been like this all year. They've really – they've been 5-6 innings. So I think wasn't the thing that it's been like a month or a couple of months since they've had a guy pitch through the seventh? Like I think that they've kind of like really put that together already. They're almost postseason trained.
Well, I look at the – we don't know what their rotation is going to look like come October 2nd. But let's say Keuchel's healthy and nobody else is. Like Lance McCullers just doesn't seem to be able to give them 5 innings. Couldn't you see them being the 2011 Cardinals, but intentionally where you say, okay, Dallas Keuchel is going to go his 7 innings when he pitches, and everybody else is just going to be used in a scrambling mishmash where it's four innings out of Morton, four innings out of Devenski, four innings out of McCullers. And then you go to the what is actually a very deep open of power arms with I'm a big Michael Feliz guy. You've got Ken Giles there. Hopefully Will Harris will be healthy by then. You've picked up Liriano. It could be the first team that kind of just goes into a full Strat-O-Matic mode and says, we're not going to worry about the whole starting pitcher bullpen, and we're just going to treat them all as pitchers. I don't know that they'll do that, but the Astros are as far ahead in terms of like having like a stat-heady, original-thinking front office as any team in baseball. And if there's a team that's going to do it, I think it will be the Astros.
Yeah, if anyone was going to do it, it'd be them, and it would be fun, man. It would be something. It'd be something to see. Okay, let's go to the Central. Obviously, the Indians have gotten hot at the same time that the Royals have gotten hot. The Indians, you know, I think we kind of know where they stand. The Twins kind of stepped up a little bit to pretend they were contending and then kind of backed off. The idea that Jaime Garcia is the physical representation of the fortnight of the Twins deciding whether or not they are going to contend is kind of amusing. But I want to kind of focus on the Royals a little bit. You know, we've talked about, obviously, with just to hark back to your days with Ranny, but I kind of feel, I wrote about this, and I think other people have written about this as well, the idea that if you're living on the edge of history and there is no future regardless, you might as well just go crazy. It's party like it's 1999. Like, it's all over for the Royals really kind of after this year anyway. They have to completely restart something. Why not go all the way through with it? So I understand some of the moves they made and so on. It still feels like they could have done more. If they are pretending as if the year 2018 and beyond does not exist and they still don't seem to be planning for that time at all, at that point, push for Jay Bruce, like push for something like that. Do you think the Royals needed to do more with what they were doing? Or at this point, do you just kind of like ride it out and press your luck?
Well, the Royals did match the market particularly well. The Royals could really use a true number one starter. That guy didn't exist on this market. I spent all day yesterday fighting over whether Darvish and Gray were number one starters. But even to the extent that they could have gotten – those guys were available, the Royals didn't have what it would take to get there. The Royals couldn't have matched the packages that Darvish and Gray were going to go for. It's actually not a very good farm system, which is one of the reasons the world ends for them at the end of September or at the end of October, as the case may be. Could they have done more? Sure. Did they have the assets to do more? Probably not. I thought they did well to get two relievers. And Trevor Cahill, I really like, who got knocked around his first start in that trade with the Padres. There's absolutely nothing the Royals could do to prevent the fact that they're going to probably lose 190 games in the next 2 years. And they might not make the playoffs for quite some time after that. But they could end this run, the Hosmer, Moustakas, Gordon run, with another trip to the playoffs. And if there's any team that can tell you what can happen if you just get into the wild card game, it's the Royals. So I think they did a really good job. I'm not somebody who goes out of his way to praise the Royals front office, but given what they had to work with, I think they did everything right. And we'll see. They might still, you know, they'll go out and claim a guy on waivers, try to make a couple waiver deals in August. I'm stunned. I never thought this team would be good enough to even be in this part. And again, this isn't the National League. This is the American League. But they've outplayed the Rays through 100 games. They've outplayed the Rangers through 100 games. You got to take that seriously. So I think whereas 2 years ago, everything was wrapped up in the Royals' right way to play, Ned Yost, all this nonsense. I don't say nonsense. It was real stuff. The narrative versus the reality when it came to the Royals. I feel like the 2017 Royals are a much more feel-good, hey, go for it, this will be a lot of fun story.
Yeah, you know, I skipped the team in the West I wanted to actually kind of talk about similar with this, which is Seattle. Certainly, Seattle is, right now, as we speak, they are 2.5 games out of the wild card. They're tied with Tampa Bay, so I probably should, if we're going to talk about Tampa Bay, I should probably talk about the Mariners. They brought in Erasmo Ramirez. They, I guess, are similarly, if not quite as extreme as the Royals, kind of on the edge of history. It feels like they've had a series of, I always think of what Michael Lewis said in Moneyball about the Red Sox. They're having a series of undignified gallops toward a desperate postseason run. The Mariners are always trying to get there and always putting it all, kind of going more in than they should to get there. Should they just do the same thing as the Royals? Is just be like, just go all in. This is maybe your last shot anyway, even if you've got guys like Cano and Seager moving forward for a while?
Yeah, even though you own those players, I mean, how much more can you squeeze out of this core? You know, Cano's 34, Cruz is 62 or 63 years old. Right. You know, Seager's even 29, Felix is 31, although he's not, whether you can argue with his part of the core anymore. You're getting this great year out of James Paxton. I think they're in the same boat where you had to go. But again, you know, Tyler O'Neill, the got, you know, they got Marco Gonzalez for him. They traded for David Phelps. They traded a bunch. They just don't have a lot there. You know, their top prospect is good, but I'm blanking on the name. But I mean, they were in a team that had an Eloy Jimenez or Blake Rutherford to put into a trade, or Willie Calhoun. So there was only going to be so much they could do. I do wonder, they're the team with the longest playoff drought, you know, since 2001, and a year that now looks like really a stone fluke if you look back at it. And you look at, if it doesn't happen this year, when's it going to happen? Like, are the Mariners are like a year away from being the Tigers?
Yeah.
Where they're a year away from being a year away, and all of a sudden now you're looking at a rebuild. You know, they signed Robinson Cano. We all hated the contract. He started – he had a terrible half season, but the contract's actually worked out for them. But you're still looking at five more years on it at, what is it, $20-odd million a year. It's not a good farm system. It's not a good player development regime at all. I mean, they've just not done a very good job. And Jerry DePoto – bless his heart, has been dancing as fast as he can to make all of these trades, a lot of which has worked out. I mean, I didn't love the Taiwan Walker trade, but Gene Segura has been fantastic. Mitch Haniger hasn't hit in 8 weeks, but he's better than I expected him to be. He's revamped the bullpen. I give DePoto a lot of credit, but it may just not happen. And if it doesn't happen this year, again, you're chasing the Astros. The Rangers have a better talent core. You're probably ahead of the Angels and A's just by default, but okay, so now you're the third best team and you're the seventh or eighth best team in the league. It's a tough future. It's very tough. If you're in the middle and you can look up, that's one thing. But if you're in the middle on the backside, where the Tigers have been the last couple of years, where you might argue that the Cardinals have started to get to, that's a really tough place to be.
Awesome. That'll be fun. Everyone will handle that.
Sorry,
well.
Brother. The Giants. I mentioned the Giants too. The Giants are basically a year away from all this too.
Yeah. So, but Buster Posey isn't fighting with Bruce Bochy over social media. So there's that.
No.
I want to get back to the Indians and in the AL Central. Did they need to get a starter? Or it's strange. I've kind of focused on this in my sports center thing about Cleveland. It's funny because last year it felt like they were so urgent last year, and it felt like they were, you know, obviously making the Miller trade. There was a sense of real urgency for the Indians. This year, where the division is actually, I think, as close as it was last year, they seem to feel comfortable with what they have, even with the Royals kind of running like that. Do you think the Indians have this settled down? Do you think it's okay that they, other than the Smith move, they didn't make any major moves?
I had a reader pester me on Twitter the other day asking, you know, please write about the Indians. You haven't written about the Indians, which is true. The Indians are one of the teams I've written about the least this year. In fact, I don't think I wrote about them at all the first half. And what it is like, the closer a team plays to expectations, the less likely I am to write about them. And the Indians are 57-47. They're on pace to, what would that be, 88 wins? And that's pretty much what I expected the Indians to be. So there's just not been a lot to write about. I mean, there's interesting stories. Bradley Zimmer coming up and being the fastest player in baseball. You know, Andrew Miller kind of going back to being used more like a conventional reliever, but still with a heavier workload than we see the best relievers get nowadays. Corey Kluber remains maybe the most underrated starter in baseball. There are individual stories, but at the end of the day, they're leading the division and they expected to lead the division. I agree that, you know, I didn't think they'd have only a 2-game lead over the Royals, but, you know, projected out, and I think the Indians are still, what, a 4-1 favorite to win the division, even with only having a 2-game lead. They just got Danny Salazar back, and I think that's going to be a critical thing for them. Mike Clevenger is starting to get knocked around, you know, kind of his Tomlin light. No, not Mike Tomlin either. Josh Tomlin. There we go. Randy Tomlin, Mike Tomlin, Josh Tomlin. Here we go.
Yes.
But Mike Salazar's come back. Salazar's come back. That's going to be an important thing for them. I think now you look at Carrasco, Kluber, Salazar. I love what the Dodgers have. I love what the Nationals have. But if you have to go three deep in the playoffs, is anybody better than that?
Yeah, I think you're right. And it's funny how you look as great as Houston is, and then we'll get into what the teams in the East are doing. Cleveland does still kind of look like the team that's most set up that way for a playoff. It's funny to think, because, you know, last year going to the playoffs, I think, what was that Cleveland reporter that had to like go jump in the lake because he thought the Indians
were done after.
Yeah, and it was funny because by the time they made the playoffs last year, they looked like actually a perfectly constructed playoff team, other than maybe having no third starter. But going, and they feel like they're in a better position going into this year. So now we go to the AL East. Obviously, the biggest move was the Yankees move. I know you've been talking about the idea whether Sonny Gray's a number one starter or not. And I'll say this, and I'm curious what your thoughts on it are. It does feel that because the universe had been so shifted the last couple of years, where the Yankees were not only not buyers, but occasionally even sellers, the idea that they went out and made a daring or a big move at the deadline has made people act as if they traded for Yu Darvish rather than, or as if they traded for, you know, an idea of a number one. Gray, it's funny to think that a year ago, it just looked like the A's had missed their window on Gray. And now the Yankees are getting Gray and they're like, okay, here come the Yankees are going to win this thing. Do you fall somewhere in the middle on that? What's your ultimate take on that deal? Not just with what they got, but what they gave away.
I think Gray is a three, and I'll defend that all day. I think that a three helps the Yankees. If you look at them, you know, they just lost Michael Pineda for the year. Both Jordan Montgomery and Luis Severino are unlikely to make 32 starts and their 200 innings. Montgomery's already, I believe, put in the bullpen. Severino, I think at some point they're going to have to tap the brakes on him. I want to say through 150 innings last year. I feel like they're going to want to try to find some six-man rotation, some type of solution. So adding Gray and Garcia, who they got much more cheaply than they did Gray, I think helps the team. For the Yankees, it's as much about 2018 and 19. In the same way that the Cubs trading for Quintana was about 18, 19, and 20. The Yankees are, you know, CeCe Sabathia is a free agent at the end of the year. Masahiro Tanaka can opt out of his contract at the end of the year. Pineda, now we know, is out for the year. They just, you know, Caprellian wasn't going to help them next year anyway. They were looking at, you know, real problems filling out the rotation next year. So adding Sonny Gray for the next 2 years at ARB salaries is a big win for them. So it helps them this year, but it's a future trade as much as anything else. And, you know, they made it without trading. I think they gave a good package. I think they gave a very high variance package. Like, there's a chance James Caprellian ends up making a lot of money playing baseball. Once he gets healthy, he gets his elbow repaired, he gets back on the mound. You know, Dustin Fowler had rushed his way up to the major leagues and then, you know, had the knee injury in his first game. The A's may work out very well here, but I think the Yankees look and say, hey, look, we didn't give up Torres, we didn't give up Florial, we didn't give up Frazier, we're okay with it.
Then you go to the Red Sox, they've continue to try to find that bridge to Kimbrel guy. That Reed is the next one to try to do that. But, you know, this still, it's funny. I can never quite tell whether everything is fine with the Red Sox, everything is crazy with the Red Sox, or everything is fine with the Red Sox. It's just that everyone that works in Boston media is insane. Like, I never quite figure out this. I, you know, a couple of weeks ago, it looked like they were going to run away with this division. Now they've come back a little bit. Who do you think, I'm curious, who do you think, looking at the rosters, should be the favorite moving forward in this division? The Yankees, the Red Sox, or even the Rays?
I'm disinclined to change my predictions in season. And I guess if you're ever going to do that, the trade deadline is the moment to do that when the rosters have been shaken up. And I will say that for the first time all year, I look at the Yankees as certainly a contender with the Red Sox for the division. The depth in the bullpen, the adding Gray, not giving up anything off the major league roster, concerns about the Red Sox offense, all those things play into that. I still am sticking with the Red Sox will win the division, but I now look at the Yankees as one of the favorites in the wild card, whereas previously I believe I had the Rays and the Rangers in the wild card game. I've been behind the Rays all year. The Rays have come out in the second half and had like six bad losses, just games they just had no business losing. And, you know, that's going to hurt them in the long term. But, you know, they traded for Duda. It's weird. It's a Rays team where the offense isn't as much concern as the pitching has been. You know, Chris Archer has been one of the most frustrating guys in baseball. I thought he'd be a superstar by now, and he's had 2 years in a row now that hasn't happened. You know, the bullpen's been shaky. Kevin Cash has an awful habit of leaving his starters in three batters too long. I mean, these are all things that you can't get away with if you're a true talent 85 win team. You can't be giving away wins on the margins because your manager can't get a starter out of the game, even though he has a deep, you know, an 8-man bullpen. So I'm sticking with my original predictions just because that's what I do. But I think the Yankees are pretty well positioned. You give them credit for bringing along the young players. You know, Aaron Judge has been far better than anybody would have ever projected him to be. That's player development. That's something that's not luck. That's a team developing a player.
So this brings us to the last team I want to talk about, which are the Baltimore Orioles. The Orioles.
Why?
This is, again, you know, I wrote a column off your idea, the idea that you want a team to either win seven in a row or lose seven in a row at the deadline, so you know one way or the other what you've got. The Orioles seem generally immune to this sort of self-diagnosis. The idea that they would bring in Helix. And again, it's not like they traded for Sonny Gray, but or they traded for Darvish would probably be a better example because he's a free agent. But it's not like they traded. But the idea that this would be a buyer of a team, you know, I feel like we've spent the last month and a half saying this is the time for them to trade Machado. If they're not going to trade Machado now, what are they even doing? Not only do they not do that, not only do they not trade Britton, they actually bring guys in. I feel like the last 4 or 5 years, because of the work that Buck Showalter has done and some of the nice little and some of the kind of the overperformance they've had some of these guys, has made people kind of forget what this organization is. And I get a sense we're about to get a very vivid reminder.
Right. And you look at the Orioles' future, the 2018 to 2022, and they could be one of the worst teams in baseball because the core is now going to get old. Their best player is going to leave in free agency. It's a bad farm system. They've shown no ability to draft. They literally treat their allotment of international money as something to be traded away. It's a joke in the industry how much the Orioles just give away their draft. It was slots for a while. Now it's just money. They just don't want to sign international players. You can't win that way in the modern game. You can't punt the ability to get incredibly cheap talent and expect to be good long term. The Orioles are going to be right there with the Tigers holding up the rest of the American League, you know, for around the turn of the decade.
Unless they get hot this year.
Based on, but the base is just not there. It's just, I mean, they gave away Yunsoo Kim as like their sixth best hitter, and they gave him away in the Helixson deal. They gave him away for Helixson, who's, we're now going to marry the ninth highest fly ball rate in baseball to the seventh best home run park in baseball.
I'm curious, last thing on this. Do you think they come to Jesus a little bit and try to trade Machado in the offseason?
I don't. I think the window. Well, it was hurt. It hurt that he had such an off year this year.
Right.
But I think if they believe they're contenders now, they're going to go into next season thinking they're not going to go this winter. Go well. Let's just rebuild. I can't see it happening. I think that they're going to go into next season saying, well, let's try it one last time with Buck and you know the Adam Jones Orioles, if you will. And you're going to be able to squint at this team and go, well, you know, if Britton's healthy and Gausman and Bundy take a step forward, as if we hadn't said that 100 times, you're going to be able to see a 78, 79 win team. And you say, well, you know, Duke's been really good at filling out the back end of the roster and Buck's worth a couple of wins a year. They're absolutely going to be able to talk themselves into contending next year. I have no doubt in my mind.
Good for them. Good for them. Good for them. All right.
Hey, look. That team can win 55 games a year. As long as Boogs is out in right field, I'm going.
I'm curious, kind of last thing to wrap up, just a general question. What are you looking for in a macro sense? We didn't get the chance to do the All-Star game podcast this year, but I'm always kind of fascinated the way that you're looking at things in a macro sense of where the game's going and kind of the directions. I know you've written a lot about strikeouts and the idea and how the game has become this almost – strikeout, three true outcomes type of game. I'm curious, moving forward, what do you think the biggest issues baseball has to deal with, not just in the next couple of months, but really for the next years coming up? And what when you're lying awake at night worrying about this game that we all love maybe a little bit too much, what's on your mind?
I'm going to say the following, well aware of the ownership structure of the podcast that I'm speaking on right now. The MLB owners have made themselves essentially strike-proof with the development and the success of advanced media / BAM tech, with the revenue stream that produces. Major League Baseball owners don't need Major League Baseball games to be played to make money. And that's going to create a long-term imbalance. And we've already seen, without that, how the owners have been beating the players over the last, you know, 5 to 10 to 15 years. I really wonder how that relationship changes as the owners become strike proof. The only thing players have is to say, we're not going to play. And if the players say we're not going to play, the owners can basically say, okay, we're just going to stream HBO over here. And you guys let us know when you're done. I feel like that's this really big structural issue and it didn't come up in 2016, but I wonder if in 2021, if the player's share of revenues continues to drop, if we continue to see veterans simply punted because teams know that they can get performance out of 22-year-olds making $500,000, I really do wonder if there's going to be a huge there's this really big conflict sitting out there in 2021. Especially, you know, baseball's revenues could drop in the 2020s because of things having nothing to do with baseball. You know, the cable wave changing and cord cutting and local revenue drying up. And if the owners still have this big side hustle, very profitable side hustle, it really changes the relationship between Major League Baseball owners and players. So it's probably not the answer you were looking for, but I really feel like that's this thing just kind of sitting out there that if we were going to lose a season in the 2020s, like it could happen if the players, because the players just can't win a strike, I don't think. I don't think the players can beat the owners in a strike because of BAM tech and the revenue it throws off.
Well, I'll have you know that you did answer my question correctly, because now I'm going to stay up late worrying about that all evening. So thank you. Thank you very much. Joe, as you know, I'm as big a fan as you have. That's probably not true. You have a lot of great fans, but I hope I'm at least in the top 15 or 20.
And I'm as big a fan as you have by volume.
By volume. Well, all right. So as always, everyone, I tell everybody, I told this at the beginning of this podcast, every single time I get a chance, subscribe to the Joe Sheehan Baseball Newsletter. Just started season, just switch the role. Right after July 31st, started over to the next season.
If the fiscal year ends on July 31st, for reasons we don't have to get into here, but is now the eighth year of the newsletter in its current form. I've been writing the newsletter for about as long as I was writing the Prospectus Today column at BP. It's really funny to think about that. But I'm just going to start telling people that I started the paid content wave. Yes. With The Athletic now and Boston Sports Journal and DK on Sports. Everybody's following in my wake. So I'm going to actually start talking to those people about getting a cut of their revenue. But no, seriously, I hope people check out the newsletter. I love writing about baseball and people seem to love reading it. So.
Yes, and they do. And of course, follow you always at @Joe_Sheehan. Joe, thank you as always. It is an honor. Enjoy the rest of the season.
You too, brother.
All right, that is our show this week. We'll be back later on. We got a bunch of shows next week, so we'll be back next week. But mostly, go back and listen to this one again because Joe's that awesome. Otherwise, have a great week. Talk to you next week.